Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. You probably know these words, right? The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Now, I get relaxed just reading this. Psalm 23 begins with this beautiful picture. Perhaps that's why it's recited more than any other text in Scripture. Psalm 23 has comforted soldiers in war and those grieving. It's brought solace to those who have faced extreme hardship. Encouragement to untold many people who have turned to this psalm in times of difficulty. Many people who don't even profess any sort of faith are still drawn to the words of Psalm 23 and maybe even know them by heart. And when I hear the final verse of this psalm, I almost want to just take in a deep breath and calm down. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. And I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Now, I wonder, when you hear these words, what kind of place you begin to picture? The quiet pastures, still waters. I, just out of curiosity, Googled Psalm 23. I do that with everything, it seems. To get a sense of what other people picture with Psalm 23. And you come up with pictures like this. This is a sort of painting with some little sheep in the foreground, and everything's soft and fuzzy and green. Here's another one that you can almost see the sheep smiling, sitting on this nice green pasture. There were pictures like this that kind of spoke to me with the hills in the background. There we have the quote, "He makes me lie down in green pastures beside still water." I like this one especially because it's in the mountains. But we come across pictures like these, and so many of us hear the words of Psalm 23, and something deep in us responds to this desire for quiet, still, safe, green pastures and still waters. Perhaps we begin to create our own images in our imagination of what that would be like. Probably not too unlike some of these pictures. And if we go through the terms one by one in these first couple of verses in the psalm, we see that very clearly in the Hebrew, this speaks to peace, this speaks to safety, to rest. The green pastures in the psalm are mentioned not in terms of food for the sheep so much as the idea of rest and comfort. Likewise, the still waters invite repose. The term translated, "restores my soul," appears in other places like Psalm 19 and Lamentations 1. And the idea is to revive, to quicken, to relieve one's soul. And these paths of righteousness speak to God's guidance and a sense of having our feet guided in safety in the right way. Of course, the idea of goodness and mercy following after us all the days of our life, residing in God's presence forever. These are awesome words. It's easy to see then why so many turn to Psalm 23 for comfort from these words. And yet, comfort and relief so often seem to be the farthest thing from the picture we actually live in. Rarely looks like those Google images, does it? Except for those few moments where you get to get away. During the 2004 presidential election, it was interesting that they termed a new type of voter, a new segment of people. You've heard the term soccer mom? Most of you have heard that. Drives the minivan, chases their kids around to practice and all that. Well, there was a new term coined of security mom. Security mom is a voting block. And there was an editorial, I believe it was in USA Today, that depicted the daily viewpoint of a security mom. And I just want you to hear this. "I am what this year's election pollsters call a security mom. I'm married with two young children. I own a gun and I vote. The September 11th, 2001 terrorist attack shook me out of my Generation X stupor. Unlike Hollywood and the New York Times and the Ivory Tower, I have not settled back casually into a September 10th way of life. I've studied the faces on the FBI's most wanted list. When I ride the train, I watch for suspicious packages and empty seats. When I'm on the highways, I pay attention to large trucks and tankers. I make my husband take his cell phone with him everywhere, even on a quick milk run or on a walk to the community pool. We have educated our 4-year-old daughter about Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. She knows that there are very bad men in the world who are trying to kill Americans everywhere. At night, we ask God to bless our troops as they risk their lives trying to kill the bad men before they kill us. Can you hear the fear in that statement? It's pretty glaring, isn't it? Can you imagine a life where everywhere you go, you have to continually stare everyone down as a potential threat, sizing up everything around you, that you can't even drive down I-5 without showing concern at all the large vehicles going by because they could endanger you. The idea, you know, I carry my cell phone a lot, but the idea that I couldn't even go down the street without it because of fear that something might happen. Worse, as a father, I can't even imagine teaching my 4-year-old to focus their prayers that God would kill the bad guys before they kill us. This is sadly a picture of what fear in daily life looks like. And though we might read an editorial like this and think, well, that's a little extreme, the question that we started to sort of address last week is that really that different than our larger culture that we're a part of? Is life just a series of endless safety measures? Are we constantly sizing up the things around us and living in fear? As I listen to those words, I don't think that feels very much like this, unless there's a cougar or bear just out of the frame about ready to devour you, or a violent thunderstorm on the horizon you can't see yet. But the reality is, even as I consider the words of that editorial, that the world is, in fact, a scary place, isn't it? It's a scary place. I read just yesterday about a pastor in Louisiana being shot in the middle of his service and killed. And of course, I immediately thought, what would I do if somebody came in the back door and, well, there's not much I could do. Oh, that's kind of uncomfortable. This morning, it seems at least one newscaster says there's a 99.9% chance that our government will shut down because people can't get along, agree on anything, it seems. Last week, we saw a little easing, but there's been some tension the last few weeks about Syria and what Russia and Iran are going to do and what we're doing. And at times, it's felt like maybe we're right on the brink of war. If that's not enough, last week we found out that the bad guys are now even entering shopping malls and killing shoppers. And this past week, my kids were part of what I'm told was a live shooter drill at the elementary school across the street. My kids are part of that. The world is a scary place, is it not? It's a scary place. So the question is, how do we respond in faith, and how do we reconcile our world with the picture David writes of in Psalm 23? You know, some specifics. How do I remain hospitable to strangers when I grew up being told not to talk to them? They're a threat. How do I remain generous when every single time I read a paper or look at the internet or turn on the news, I'm told that all of our financial world is going to come crashing down again? How do I courageously seek peace with those who might in fact want to harm me? How do we go about that in faith? We're going to deal specifically with those three challenges in the next couple weeks, but this morning I just want us to consider how we reconcile our lives with the passages like Psalm 23 that we read. To do that, I first want to understand the context that this psalm is written in. Some of you may have noticed that I left a couple verses out when we read that earlier. Look to Psalm 23 again with me. If you have your Bible, feel free to turn there. Let's consider this psalm. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Here's the part I skipped. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. And then these wonderful words, surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. So where's David walking again in this psalm? There's a valley mentioned, right? Which valley is that again? One in the shadow of death, right? By the way, there is an actual historical place here. This is most certainly referencing, also known as the Old Jericho Road. From the air, this is in fact what that area looks like. Maybe that's not your picture of pastures and quiet waters. If you can make out, there's almost a maze of these canyons they call wadis. If you've ever been to like Canyonlands National Park, it's almost that kind of place where you couldn't walk across this scene because you're going to constantly get hit with these canyons that are impasses. And this is just east of Jerusalem. And as you come to this complex system of deep canyons, these wadis that are cut through the mountains, if you go back to a time before there were paved roads and superhighways, if you wanted to travel from a place like Jericho or points east to Jerusalem, the only way really to do that practically wasn't to go over the sea of hills in this maze. The only way to do it would be to take the Old Jericho Road, which was up one of these twisting, very deep canyons or wadis. And part of this road was, in fact, called the Valley of the Shadow of Death. This is a picture down into it. And if you look right up there, you may not make it out, there's actually a monastery there nowadays. One of my dreams in life is someday to go spend a week there. Cool place. I got to see it from across the canyon. Talk about remote. But it's given its name because if you look down in the bottom, there's sort of a river there in the shadow, right? And it twists and turns, and real hard to escape up the sides, right? You're kind of trapped. So the problem was, as you came from Jericho up towards Jerusalem, there were all these places where bandits and bad guys could hide out and wait for you. And if they surprised you, there was nowhere to go. You were stuck. Thus, the Valley of the Shadow of Death. This is another picture without the shadows to kind of see what that looks like. If you can imagine coming around a corner, you have very few options. And you can understand why then travelers were incredibly nervous when they had to take this road and usually did so in large numbers so as not to be vulnerable. And yet, as David pens this psalm, he recognizes that God can make a place like the dreaded Valley of the Shadows of Death operate like the place with peaceful pastures and quiet waters. Someone has suggested this may actually be a pretty accurate picture of what Psalm 23 entails. I don't know if you can see, there's a shepherd there and a bunch of sheep. And there is, in fact, some water. And there is, in fact, little patches of pasture. But maybe that's not the picture you get when you think of Psalm 23. You see, David isn't simply saying following God means that all the places you'll go will be picturesque vacation destinations with babbling brooks and not a care in the world, far from danger. But I think when I consider us, some of our fear and anxiety comes from the reality that that's actually what we falsely expect. I was just talking with a good friend this week, and we were talking through the idea of disappointment in life, and we were discussing the reality that when you really get down to it, most of our disappointments are a result of our own expectations not being met. We create the expectations, and then we're disappointed when they're not met. And in the same way, so much of our anxiety comes from false expectations in life and what it's supposed to be. Rather than saying that life is going to be easy and picturesque, David is saying that God's presence and protection is so great that even in a place like the Valley of the shadow of death, God can lead him to rest. He doesn't have to fear evil even there because God is with him. In fact, if you look closely again, this part about this meal, who are the other guests apparently that are joining him? You prepare a table before me in the presence of my good friends, right? No, it's right in the presence of my enemies. David takes joy in the reality that he is even safe seated at the table when the room is filled with those who would kill him. Even in their presence, God provides overflowingly, and this oil on his head is a sign of God's blessing on his life, even in the presence of his enemies. As I consider this, I think we're deeply challenged in a culture that's full of airbags and seatbelts and bike helmets, antibacterial soap, all those things not all of us grew up with, but now my kids can't ride a bike without a helmet on. We live in a constant expectation, I think, of safety. In fact, if I was to dig deeper, and we don't have time to get into this completely this morning, but I think we have a sense of entitlement about safety that I think is actually a fairly proud thing. That somehow, because we're Americans or because of what our parents did or because of whatever, we're entitled to safety and comfort and freedom from harm. So we have this constant expectation, this idea of safety that in reality our world will never live up to. We consider that security mom. We spend billions initially to keep knives off of planes, and what do we see happen? Someone sews a bomb into their underwear or puts it in their shoe or puts a printer on a plane hidden with explosives. Or now we're told that some might even be surgically implanting such things into their bodies to get through TSA security scans. When I consider that, the reality is that all of the TSA and Homeland Security that money could possibly buy can never create that truly safe and sanitized reality. We could build a 100-foot-tall wall all along our borders. We could put guards at every one of our ports. We could do everything imaginable, and the reality is there are still going to be bad people who find a way around that. I don't mean that as a political statement. I'm not suggesting we don't do anything. That's just the reality. Just like you and I could wash our hands with that antibacterial soap 20 times a day, but you're still going to get sick at some point, aren't you? It is a good idea to wash your hands, but you can't keep yourself safe. You can eat the most healthy diet, you can exercise every day, you can look like a picture of fitness and still get cancer. I've had friends have this happen. But somehow we're caught in this expectation and belief that we can live in a world where bad things should not be happening to us, that it's idyllic. So when they do happen, we often are shocked because we're convinced we were protected from them, far from their reach. Hopefully that's not too harsh. I think I'm just being real. It seems like when we read Psalm 23, sometimes we almost have this assumption as though God is airlifting David out of the valley of shadow of death and dropping him off in a different location altogether. When in fact he's leading David into the valley of the shadow of death. But God's presence is what brings protection and blessing, even in a place such as that. And when we think that way, we get stuck believing that God will keep us miles from any potential danger or evil, when in fact he might lead us right through it. But he'd be with us. So if that's the case, how are we to approach evil and danger in a life that is lived out in authentic faith? I want to consider some words together of Jesus. If you want to turn to Luke chapter 9. For some of you, all of these passages are probably familiar. Some maybe not. Luke chapter 9. Jesus is sending out his disciples. They come back. He's giving some instruction. Verse 23, this is what he says to them. And he said to them all, "If anyone would come after me, Let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. Well, that already doesn't sound real safe or comfortable. For whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? Do you hear the promise here? If you follow Jesus, you will actually lose something. But he'll save it. But if you try to save it, you're going to lose it. If you flip to Matthew chapter 10, here Jesus is sending out his disciples. If you pick up in verse 16, behold, I am sending you out. We have sheep again, kind of like the shepherd, right? A little different, though. Behold, I'm sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. So be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. Beware of men, for they will do what? They'll deliver you over to courts and flog you. It's a really nasty form of beating someone in their synagogues. So they're going to beat you in their holy places. And you will be dragged before governors and kings for my sake to bear witness before them and the Gentiles. Sounds a little violent. But when they deliver you over, do not be anxious. Again, not because you won't be harmed, but why? Don't be anxious how you are to speak or what you are to say, for what you are to say will be given to you in that hour. For it is not you who speak, but the Spirit of our Father speaking through you. The concern here is, don't worry, I'm going to give you the gospel message even when you're getting beat up, even when you're getting dragged into court. There isn't a promise of, don't worry, it won't sting. It won't hurt. He goes on. Brother will deliver brother over death, and father his child, and children will rise against parents and have them put to death, and you will be hated by all for my name's sake. That's what Jesus promises. John 17, when Jesus is getting ready to go to the cross, and he prays for his disciples and then for future believers. There's something, I think, really stunning in what he prays for his disciples. If you jump down to verse 14 in John 17, he's praying this in front of his disciples. They can hear him. It says, I have given them your word, and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. And then this is that statement. Jesus says, I do not ask that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one. In other words, don't airlift them out of the valley of the shadow of death to this separate, happy, safe place. Actually, keep them there. But that you would keep them from the evil one. It goes on, they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world. If you sent them into the world, so sent me, so I have sent them. So how did Jesus get sent into the world? There was some suffering involved, wasn't there? Wasn't an easy task, was it? See, we need to understand that central to the gospel is this reality that God has called us into a dangerous reality in following Jesus Christ. We need to understand that from this world perspective, following Christ in faith will cost you and me personally. It will hurt at times. God does not seem to remove us from the valley of the shadow of death, but he is present with us in it. So that even in a place such as that, David can write that we can rest. So then how do we respond? I like to go into the woods. Is it a lack of faith for me to bring bear spray? Don't worry, I won't touch this. If it sprayed, we'd all go running. Is it lack of faith for me to put this on my backpack and carry that in because I should just not worry? I would suggest it isn't lack of faith. It's actually kind of smart. But I carry this knowing that even with a can that sprays really nasty pepper spray at a high rate of speed, I could pull that out if I see a grizzly and it still might charge me. I may not stop it. So even with those tools and those things that are going into grizzly country, that's a really smart thing to carry, by the way. But even with that, I can either have a false assumption that I'm going to be free from harm, or I could be paralyzed and unable to move and never leave a trailhead because, oh my goodness, there might be a bear around the corner, and what will it do to me? That's not faithless to be smart. It's not faithless to tell my kids, hey, when a stranger comes up to you and offers you something or says, get in my car, you shouldn't do that. However, I realize that there will always still be risk. Bears still charge sometimes after being sprayed. Bad people may come along my kids' paths, and I may not be able to stop it. So I can either stay at home and bubble wrap my kids. Even that doesn't seem to help. Or I can do what is wise, knowing there's still risk, and trust God. Likewise, when I have that moment of opportunity like I did yesterday to speak with a friend or an acquaintance boldly about Christ, I know there's always risk. I felt it yesterday. This guy might reject me. This might be our last conversation. It's always there. And sometimes I am rejected. Some of you experience this even with people you love very much. When you tell them the truth about Christ, they don't want to hear it. But does that keep me from speaking of Jesus in fear? God, help me know. Thomas Aquinas, hundreds of years ago, wrote quite a bit about fear and how we should test our fears. He said something I think very profound, that fear arises from the imagination of future evil. Sort of like being afraid of the boogeyman. He's not actually in your room, but you imagine he could be there, and so you're afraid. A fear arises from the imagination of future evil. He went on to say something we believe that would threaten the loss of something we love. So we fear what we should not because either the perceived threat is in fact not great and imminent, or because what we're afraid of losing we should not love in the first place. So as he plays this out, he sort of categorizes these different things that we as believers can get caught up in fearing, like the thing that isn't in fact great, like a spider. Anyone have an irrational fear of spiders? Really, a couple of you. I had a good one. You know what a hobo spider is? They're really nasty. Okay, the giant house spider looks just like them. And maybe this is going to hurt your attendance, but there have been a couple giant house spiders in our church. And Jim Long and I have both been the ones to come along them. Jim, you found one in the dark and thought it was a piece of lint and picked it up, right? And that was a little shocking. I saw one and thought it was a hobo spider, and you know, and it was a Sunday morning a long time ago, and covered it up with a cup and kept it for our resident scientist to tell me what it was because I thought it was deadly. We can be afraid of things that aren't in fact something to be afraid of, right? It's not great. Likewise, we can be afraid of things that actually are scary, but they're not imminent. Like the financial world could collapse. Probably won't tomorrow. We can be afraid of things because we're afraid of losing something we love that we shouldn't, like our possessions. Thomas Aquinas says that most fear arises from the imagination of future evil. So we come back to Psalm 23, and this morning, can we just recognize that there is danger that is real, that we cannot protect ourselves from? That God, rather than removing danger from our lives or difficulty, often instead walks right through it with us. And even in the presence of enemies, even in the presence of a dangerous place like the valley of the shadow of death, if God's presence is with us, we have provision, protection, even in those very backdrops. I think when we miss that truth, that God's protection and provision often is in those very difficult places, not removing us from them. Our lives become filled often with all sorts of reactive protection measures. Someone hurt us, so we're no longer going to allow ourselves to be vulnerable or transparent. In fact, we have some sayings around this, right? Like, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me, right? Kind of that idea of, no, I'm going to react, I'm going to put up a wall so nobody can hurt me again. Maybe, like my brother-in-law, you've tasted poverty, and so you're doing everything to make sure you never go back to that place. We're in danger of hoarding our resources. Or maybe you've laid yourself out there and been taken advantage of, and so you no longer will act in radical generosity because it could happen again. You see, we build these protective measures, don't we? I wonder this morning what protective measures you tend towards in your life to create a false sense of safety. Have you thought about that? Do you realize you probably do it? What protective measures do you tend towards to create a false sense of safety? Perhaps you're not as vulnerable as you used to be, or there are things that are just off limits to everybody. Perhaps you don't trust others the way you should. Perhaps you're unwilling to speak about Jesus in certain situations because it could go poorly. I don't know what it is for you. But I wonder if you're aware of one or more of those things in your life this morning. And you're aware that you're creating protective measures. If you'd be willing to, instead of trying to protect yourself from evil, allow God to walk with you in its presence. There's quite a difference there, isn't there? I'm going to have the worship team come up, and as they do, I'd love if we could actually recite Psalm 23 together. Would you do that with me? The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Father, when we consider the context of these words, that they were written in the midst of incredible danger and hardship, how striking a faith that in this psalm could be penned this reality that even though we walk into the most difficult realities, the most dangerous places, when we understand your greatness and your love for us, we realize where safety really comes from. Father, I pray that the power of these words would be resident in our lives. Father, if there are those here this morning who are gripped by fear, who perhaps are living a life with various protections set up in place, Father, I would pray you would bring freedom. You would help all of us to see that the valley of the shadow of death has no power over us when you're with us. That you, our God, can turn even such a place into a beautiful green pasture and still waters. Father, we want to entrust you with our lives. We want to entrust you with our fears. Help us see not always to ask that you would remove us from those difficult things, but instead to simply rest in the fact that your presence is there with us. Help us to trust you, to walk in faith today. I pray this in Jesus' name.